Spank that Bottas. It's time for another flat chat. And with two Grand Prix in the bag already, it's looking like Red Bull have the upper hand. The latest issue of GP Racing magazine is now on the newsstands, and we have a man with a moustache and a mullet on the cover. Joining me to go back to the 1980s, perhaps to begin a fist fight with Patrick Swayze over a few cartons of Tia Maria outside the Roadhouse, it's from South Australia, Mark Gallagher.
Great to be joining you. And I have to just warn the listeners that it is almost midnight at the time of recording, and I've been at a very nice and very enjoyable dinner party where there was much Shiraz and Riesling being shared by local winemakers. So I think my contribution to this podcast may be actually a huge improvement on normal.
Well, let's move over and say hello to the only person with enough hair to grow a mullet, should he desire. But actually, do you know, if I put my mind to it, I could, but it would go through a terrible curly stage. Live from the Midlands, it's Matt Q.
Hello, thank you for having me on the show, Codders.
So, besides the moustache and the mullet, you'll probably be seeing more of Valtteri Bottas than you ever thought you wanted to in this month's GP racing. There's an interesting and distinctive headline and opening image to accompany Oleg Karpov's exclusive no-holds-barred interview. And in the interests of full transparency, I should point out this was all Oleg's idea. Now, Matt, you got a sneak preview in Bahrain just as Oleg was freaking out over whether he'd done the right thing. So you knew what was coming. Mark, what did you see? What did you think, rather, when you saw the spread?
The spread, so to speak. I have to say it's a very peachy interview. I was delighted because, I mean, quite naturally, you know, there's a tendency for everyone to focus on the championship winners and the race winners and the number one drivers and the superstars and the top teams, and that's completely natural. You know, that's what, you know, so much of the focus is on. And yet, there are so many stories to be told up and down this grid. And when you take someone like Valtteri, who, you know, was teammate to Lewis Hamilton and was therefore in the hot seat in terms of seeing what Lewis has developed into, particularly in the post Nico Rosberg phase of his career at Mercedes-Benz. You know, Valtteri's story personally is so interesting, but then also his ability to observe what happened, you know, between him and Lewis and with working with Lewis and competing against Lewis as a teammate and all of the facets of that. I find that really interesting. I think, it's sort of part of my career that's tended to touch upon, you know, very successful drivers who ultimately were, you know, number two in their team. I mean, Eddie Irvine was a lodger for me when he was in my house when he was in junior formula. And obviously I kept in touch with Eddie when he ended up all the way through to being teammate to Michael Schumacher. And then obviously David Coulthard, you know, who I still work a lot with. David will tell you quite happily that it was his misfortune to arrive at the top of F1 as teammate to Mika Hakkinen and up against Michael Schumacher. So I think there's a story about drivers who are very capable and quick, yet ultimately get to that point where there's a kind of a road to Damascus moment where the penny drops that there's someone else that's just that little bit quicker on a sustained basis. And I think that's been one of the interesting things about Valtteri and his journey. And then subsequently, you know, his delight to get away from Mercedes and go to Alfa Romeo, where, I mean, he can let his hair down, quite literally, with the mullet that we've seen. And I think it's just great fun. You know, he's enjoying himself. He's enjoying life. He's been there, done it in terms of driving competitive race winning cars, 67 pole positions, I think he's had, and 67 podiums rather. And, you know, 10 victories. So he knows what it's like to be in a top team, and he's now in a different phase of his career. So I think, you know, for Oleg to have focused in on this and quite honestly for you to put him on the front cover in all his nakedness, it's just fantastic. It's fantastic.
Realize. Well, he was wearing a hat.
He was wearing a hat, yeah. But I think it's just really interesting. I love getting into sometimes the stories behind the headlines and sometimes the stories of the drivers behind, you know, the front runners all the time. And Valtteri, I think Valtteri's an incredibly, you know, impressive and capable driver, but rather like DC found out, you know, you get to the pinnacle and find that there's one or two other guys around who just have that edge, and that's a difficult moment. And I think it's incredibly character building.
He also did say in the interview that he used to get quite fed up with the Bottas 2.0 things, where he'd come back for a new season, he'd like have a beard or something, and people would say, "This is the new tough Valtteri Bottas." And there were people actually saying to him, "Do you know, you should be a bit more ruthless, and you should be a bit more nasty." And he sort of says in the interview, "Well, firstly, I don't want to be like that anyway. And secondly, he'd seen how another teammate doing that had played and it hadn't ended well. And thirdly, if you're going to be like that, you have to make damn sure that you get the championship over the line. Otherwise, you get fired and you don't get a job anywhere else." So for all those reasons, he just decided to carry on being Valtteri Bottas.
And I think that's brilliant, isn't it? Because we live in a world with so much sort of falsehood and lack of authenticity. And I think with Valtteri, what you see is what you get. He's a damn good racing driver. And I mean, I first came into contact with him as a competitor. I was a co-owner of Status Grand Prix when we were competing against him in GP3. And, you know, we saw we had a pretty rapid driver in Robert Wickens, and we saw what Valtteri was able to do. And obviously he sort of fairly rocketed through into that Williams drive. And I think, you know, when we look back at the beginning of that hybrid era, but for all the Mercedes domination, one of the things that was quite pleasing was that, thanks to, in part to Mercedes power, Williams were in the mix, certainly in 2014, slightly less so in 2015. But, you know, Valtteri and Felipe Massa were in there. And I enjoyed watching that, you know, because obviously you had Lewis and Nico out there banging in the victories for Mercedes. But it was neat to see Williams back in the fray. You know, as I say, we don't need to overanalyze the reasons why they were there in those early days of the hybrid formula. But, you know, Valtteri was making the most of it. And I thought that was great. And then for him to get the nod and be able to join Mercedes and replace, you know, Nico was a great thing. The other thing which was also incredibly important, and I think he doesn't get enough credit for this, was to go into a Mercedes team which had a very, very unhappy time with the Nico Lewis inter-team battle, inter-team rivalry. You know, James Allison told me on a podcast a few years ago that it was just a downward spiral. You know, you ended up with a team divided, and it just wasn't a happy time. And Mercedes really needed to put that behind them. And in signing Valtteri, you know, they got a very competitive driver, but one who was able to sit more easily with Lewis. And I mean, he played the team game brilliantly, and the team won, you know, five consecutive World Constructors Championships, you know, with Valtteri there. And Valtteri put in those Grand Prix wins when the opportunity arose. And yes, we all know he had some very poor performances, which tended to get a lot of comment around it. But the big picture to it was that in Valtteri and Lewis, Toto Wolff ended up with an incredibly harmonious team, which was able to do everything that Mercedes required of them, really. And I mean, surely from a team point of view, that's what it's all about. So I think, you know, his role in that era shouldn't be underplayed because he did what was effectively required of him. And of course, he had a good relationship with Lewis and continues to do. So I think when, you know, I don't know, 20 or 30 years time, when sport comes to look back on the Hamilton era, you know, I think Valtteri's role in that will be perhaps even better appreciated. And I know that he'll look back on everything he's achieved with great satisfaction, and he's got more in him. You know, he's enjoying life at Alpha. He scored the lion's share of the championship points for the team last season. It's obviously a much smaller team than Mercedes-Benz. And I, for one, do hope that he hangs around not just long enough, but effectively enough to capture Audi's attention for when they come into Formula One, because quite honestly, they couldn't wish to have a more experienced driver to perhaps guide them when they arrive into the sport in 2026.
Well, how do you rate the chances of that happening, Matt? Because that's a good couple of years away before the real four rings appear on the nose of that car. Valtteri's not getting any younger, but you know, the moustache and the mullet show there's still lead in the pencil yet, surely.
Yeah, so, well, he's 36 now, so precedent says he can still do a job. And actually, when was it, the Belgium Grand Prix last year, when Audi did the press conference announcing their arrival, Bottas certainly showed an interest in it and sticking around being an F1 around that time, which is obviously interesting, not to give away every aspect of Oleg's piece, but, you know, Bottas talking about seriously walking away from Formula 1 after the Mercedes era, so, or his stint at Mercedes. To say now he's up for the Audi challenge, it'd be brilliant. And you have to wonder what Audi's options are. So in an ideal world, they'd have a young German. I don't think Mick Schumacher is that guiding light, and Hülkenberg will probably be down and out of F1 for real, absolutely, definitely, 100% by then, and no more recalls. And then, you know, as we record this podcast, McLaren have just announced a restructure with James Key out, David Sanchez in, turning the tide of McLaren. Is that enough, you know, to keep Lando Norris to stay? Will Charles Leclerc be so disenfranchised at Ferrari? And then suddenly, you know, you're ticking off your contenders, your realistic runners and riders for that Audi seat. And Bottas, you know, with his experience, with his, you know, he'll be so deeply embedded in him will by then, that he's a great shout to stick around. Can I talk about off-track Bottas, please? So the Finnish thing, which always annoys journalists, I think, that you, when you do ask an eloquent question, or I think an eloquent question, then Kimi Räikkönen says yes or no, after a while that does sort of grate when you do want to get a revealing answer to develop the narrative. And Bottas, I think, is selective with his words, but he's actually turned into a fantastic, fantastic paddock spokesperson. Particularly, I think, you know, since leaving some of the corporate bubble of Mercedes behind and having a bit more free reign. I don't just mean the, you know, skinny dipping in a river and doing daft things with his hair, but like he's a great ambassador. The way he's talked about, you know, the FIA making dangerous decisions by banning tyre blankets and you know, his response to the gagging act of by changing the international sporting code. He's actually become a real, like, paragon. Like, he's not, you know, quite the replacement for Sebastian Vettel, in a sense. He's going to appear on British on Question Time and annihilate the standing attorney general at the time and just embarrass our political elite. But he's just come across so well as an eloquent person. The only slight disappointment is we're recording this straight after the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix, when, you know, he was a massive advocate of this new sporting code isn't going to change. I'm still going to talk about all the key political issues, and then declined to comment at all on Saudi Arabia. But going back there a year after the missile strike. But I suppose his silence and sort of smiles and knowing glances said an awful lot without him verbally communicating, as it were. But I think that's something should be praised, that for all his like quiet, restrained demeanor, that he picks his words carefully, and they really bite when he does say something of great importance. And I think that's perhaps an underappreciated evolution of Bottas 4.0, as he would not like to have it termed, judging by this interview.
But he probably wouldn't want to end up in jail, would he, really? Which seems to be the fate of anyone who dares criticise that regime. Anyway, moving swiftly on from regimes. Although Mark's column in next month's GP Racing does touch on the Aramco situation, but we'll leave that one hanging in the air for our listeners for next month. Elsewhere in this issue, we look at the problems facing Ferrari in a... It's quite an elegant piece of magazine craft, if I do say so myself. A two-part feature package. Roberto Quincaro, the Italian journalist and famous Matt Allwright.
it's uncanny. Any listeners, Google it. It's uncanny. He's going to go and chase after people who have badly tarmacked a drive.
He does, you know. Every time I meet him, I I've known him for years. I still sort of have a double take. It's surely not Matt Allwright, the consumer champion. Is it so expensive to get into this media centre? Anyway, Roberto looks at why Mattia Binotto got the heave ho as team principal from Ferrari last year, and what Frederic Vasseur has been doing since he slipped his feet under the desk at the end of January. Quite a lot, as it seems. And Andrew Benson analyses the prospects for Charles Leclerc and Carlos Sainz, which, you know, we say probably the second best driver lineup in Formula One in terms of, well, you have to say that probably, most people would say Lewis Hamilton and George Russell is the strongest package, with Charles Leclerc and Carlos Sainz second. But driver for a team which doesn't want to be second best. And there's been a few movements in the Ferrari story since we closed for press. And I suppose let's roll in our discussion of the thing that's pinged into our inbox just before recording started of movements at McLaren. So there's been talk of Laurent Mekies wanting to leave, potentially for a job with Formula One, but Vasseur blocking that. Mekies has certainly had his job title or remit changed. There's been word of Frederic Vasseur and Ferrari CEO Benedetto Vigna being at loggerheads over various things in terms of who controls what in the team. And, you know, last but not least, there was word that David Sanchez had cleared his desk and was beginning gardening leave. And lo and behold, over at McLaren, technical director James Key has been given the heave-ho. There's a new structure, a new technical director, and a desk marked David Sanchez. So quite a lot to unpick, Matt. Now, you've left Johnny Noble to put finger to keyboard and analyse this for Autosport. What do you make of this latest tranche of movements and also the madness at Ferrari?
It's pointed that McLaren have given James Key the heave-ho to bring in David Sanchez, because, you know, their whole thing for ages has been, well, we just need to get the new wind tunnel and simulator online, and then we're cooking, boys and girls. We're going to be right at the front of the pack again. So for them to make this call beforehand is pretty bold. But let obviously to focus on Ferrari, there's so many interesting things to pick out. First of all, I want to, having taken a mick out of the way he looks, praise Roberto, because I want listeners to understand how embedded he is in all the goings on at Ferrari. He is so well connected in that sphere that, you know, this side of Gazzetta dello Sport, if he says something about Ferrari, it's probably happening. So the way he stitches together the piece that you have headlined, right, said Fred, I imagine rubbing your hands together and laughing at your own craftsmanship as you did that is well worth reading. But I think, you know, a couple of key things to pick out is Vasseur falling up with top management is really interesting, because, you know, part of the reason Binotto had to... well, was put into a corner where he resigned is because effectively he wasn't the new management's man. He wasn't their chosen one. You know, he would come in under Marchionne. And so did the management use the decline at the end of 22 as a reason to get rid of someone who they didn't want in the first place, to bring in one of their own people, or vice versa? You know, did he have to go because the results were so bad? It just so happened that he wasn't their chosen one. But Vasseur is their chosen one. You know, from before Binotto was even left, it was talking about this is who Benedetto and John Elkman wanted in. and now he's there. So if he's already falling out with them already and he is their chosen one, that speaks of great instability. Quite which way round it is, I don't know, because if that's Vasseur coming in going, guys, this is a mess, you know, I need this and this, give me some autonomy, you know, where I need to sort of stamp my own philosophy on that, I don't know. Or if it's coming from the other way around, that's, you know, that would be more troubling, the life expectancy or the tenure of a Ferrari team principal is so short as it is, that if the rumours are true, then that is so soon on Vasseur's part. But he is going in there and throwing his weight around. So, you know, replacing the head of strategy, restricting Laurent Mekhi's role, which I don't think is quite the headline it's being made out to be. If he's not going anywhere, which, okay, I understand, you know, Vasseur saying he's not going anywhere is like a football manager saying I'm not going anywhere and need to be flicked 24 hours later. But if it's just a minimising of his role, where he's saying, you know, there's no need to do the FIA press conferences or all of that, then fine, focus on a job you do have as sporting director. There's nothing sort of particularly egregious about that. But he is obviously refining it. And I think what Vasseur is trying to do, good pal with Toto Wolff, and, you know, from what he did at Alfa Romeo or Sauber and Junior Academy, is I think he'll be better at nailing what the true working practice of a no blame culture is, because Binotto, I think his understanding of a no blame culture was slightly politely lost in translation, where no one was at fault for anything. Ferrari never made a mistake. You think of how he defended the strategy after Monaco or Silverstone last year, whereas actually a no blame culture is, you know, going, it's not X person's fault specifically. So, you know, as Mark covers in his Williams piece, so you don't have that culture of covering your own tracks rather than focusing on optimising and moving forward. So if Vasseur brings that in, that'll be a step forward. But, you know, losing David Sanchez, head of vehicle concept, and Binotto, who obviously had the split role of team principal and technical director, although Sanchez has gone straight to McLaren, in a world of Formula One gardening leaves, that is now a very depleted technical side. You know, it's about as poor shape, in effect, as Williams, where they've got their chief designer acting as a interim technical director, and it's so depleted. And obviously, that gets to a certain point where the upgrades that the SF23 now needs, both drivers said have come out and said it's not a case of setup tweaks, it's more fundamental packages. Those, and obviously the 2024 car, are all heavily steered by the technical director, so they need to appoint someone in that place ASAP. And so either they've got to promote from within or wait for these gardening periods of gardening leave to be served. So that's where it seems most turbulent at Ferrari. But Vasseur is not raising too many eyebrows by sort of chopping and changing. I think he needs to. If he said, you know, absolute stability and there's more bad strategy, more unreliability, he's done nothing about it, then he's out the door, you know, basically before he's even settled in the job. But I'd say the bigger concern is what way round has he fallen out with the CEO? Because if Vasseur was his man, their chosen one, and that relationship is already south, then that is really interesting.
Regime change is always a complicated thing, isn't it, Mark? When you're the appointee of someone who's left and a new top dog comes in, they want to stack the deck with their own people. And, you know, we saw that very much the case when Zak Brown came in at McLaren, didn't we? He replaced an awful lot of people. Even his head of PR got given the Spanish Archer rapidly enough in favour of someone Zak had worked with before.
When you take a step back from all of this, you know, the McLaren announcement made today and then the Ferrari debacle, as it appears to be at the moment, what you're seeing is two teams who really need to do something other than be focusing on infighting and restructuring. They need to get themselves sorted out because, quite frankly, the more you get involved in internal restructures, changes, upsets, all the human issues around that, which inevitably take a time to settle, all you're doing is handing an opportunity to teams who don't have that going on. Teams like Red Bull Racing, teams actually like Mercedes-Benz. You know, Mercedes, for all their troubles, at least have, as far as we know, a very unified team, which at least accepts that it's got a problem with the design philosophy in its car. They're digging quite deep to try and find a way forward. They're being incredibly open and transparent about the problems that they're having. You know, that's all really quite positive, a positive set of behaviours. Whereas, I mean, if you look at the McLaren announcement, James Key is someone who I have a huge amount of time for. I was very fortunate enough to work with him way back at Jordan Grand Prix when he was there. He's gone on to, you know, achieve a lot in his career. You know, not to put too fine a point on it, that the McLaren press release very much reads like it's James's fault that we're in the problem that we're in at the moment, and so he's left a team with immediate effect. I mean, that's the only thing that you can say about that, and that's a shame because that means that they're looking for a blame to be apportioned, and the blame is not being apportioned across the organisation. It's not the failure to succeed is not seen as an organisational failure. It's being sort of firmly planted at one person's door. And when you consider that, you know, McLaren have seen Andrea Seidel leave, they've now, you know, James Key has now gone. So this all looks, you know, like a period of instability. And instead of having a single technical director announced, they've announced that they're going to have a triumvirate approach with Peter Prodromou appointed as technical director at aerodynamics, David Sanchez, as you mentioned, technical director for car concept, and then Neil Hulde is being promoted to the newly created role, they say, of technical director engineering and designer. So you've got three technical directors, all responsible for different areas. That for me always rings an alarm bell because, again, when you look at successful team models over the year, that, you know, once you go down the kind of committee route, you kind of wonder, where does the buck stop? Who takes overall responsibility? Who's the person who's really ultimately going to call the shots in terms of the overall direction of the package, the car, the design and development, etc. So that's really the McLaren thing is really, it's interesting to see. And of course, here we are recording this podcast after the second race of the 2023 season, and we're seeing, you know, huge change taking place already. And then when you look at the Ferrari situation, I mean, I'm actually aghast at what's happening there, because the last thing that Frédéric Vasseur needed when he went into Ferrari was to then preside over a further period of change and instability. You know, the loss of David Sanchez, is the rumours surrounding Mekki's, you know, is he going to stay, is he leaving? And then you come to this whole point around his relationship with Benedetto Vigna, the chief executive of Ferrari. And I think, again, for listeners, it's really important to remember, you know, Benedetto is the chief executive officer of Ferrari. You know, he's got the top job in Ferrari. So for him, whatever else, you know, people may speculate, the reality, he's got the top job at Ferrari. And I mean, I read some of the comments that he made around the time of the Italian Grand Prix last year. He had only been in that role for just over a year. He was clearly unhappy with Ferrari's performance. Obviously, he's now, you know, seen Binotto go, and I'm sure Vigna had a role in that. And then you've seen the arrival of Vasseur. And if they are kind of headbutting each other, if there is tension between them, that is enormously problematic for Vasseur. You know, to Matt's point, you know, this is kind of the last thing that the team needs. And indeed, if you were to think about it from a Charles Leclerc perspective, you know, think about the drivers, that driver lineup that Andrew Benson has talked about in his article in the magazine. You know, the one thing the two drivers need is to feel that they're in a team that's got a united, aligned team, leadership, strong focus, strategy, direction, resources been allocated in the right area to make the car go faster, to improve those operational issues, to solve those reliability problems. And instead of that, here we are after race two of the season, they're fourth in the Constructors' Championship. You know, Leclerc started a race with a, you know, penalty as a result of all those issues with the engine electronics in the opening race. And it just looks like a little bit of chaos. And, you know, I was reflecting on when I was reading some of the stories online, you know, so Vigna, the chief executive, his background is he was a physicist, and he actually invented the sensor that's used in airbags in car crashes. And I kind of thought, that's quite interesting, because, I mean, he may be presiding over the ultimate car crash at Ferrari at the moment, and they could do with a few airbags to protect, you know, Vasseur and the other people there. Because for me, the thing that will be catastrophic is if it turns out that Vigna and Vasseur have an inability to work together, and it leads to further change. Because if that further change happens, you'd have to say Ferrari has gone further down the path towards, once again, self-destruction, instead of building on all the good work that had been achieved. And I mean, whatever anyone thinks about last season, they had a very, very fast car. Yes, they had operational problems. Yes, they had reliability problems. Yes, they had strategy problems. All those potentially could be fixed if a team is aligned and pulling in the same direction. And again, to Matt's point, understanding what no blame culture means. No blame culture doesn't mean you say, oh, well, that was another weekend where we screwed up, let's not worry about it. Blame culture is where you actually learn, sit down and say, okay, so what went wrong in that pit stop? Why did we not get the strategy right in Monaco or Spa or wherever? And you learn from it, and you say, you collectively decide, next weekend we will not repeat that, or any time in the future, and you go on this upward trajectory. And I think maybe that, exactly to Matt's point, I think that's where, you know, the well-intentioned Binotto approach ultimately didn't pay dividends, and here we are. I mean, you'd love to be able to phone up Binotto and say, so what do you reckon about everything that's happened since you left? I mean, it's a conveyor belt of misery. And Ferrari need to somehow find a different track.
It seems to me that you know, Vigna, as Roberto alludes, spent his first year in position very much focusing on the road car side, and has been taking an increasing interest in the team over the past year. And maybe do we think he might be perhaps overextending his bailiwick, as it were, because there's even talk that he decides who gets a pass to come into the paddock.
You see, it's interesting you ask this, because I need to, you know, say on the record, I don't know Laurent Rossi, but I have, you know, obviously wrote a feature for the magazine last year about Alpine. I know Otmar Szafnauer quite well. And, you know, one of the things that I think is always a warning sign is when the chief executive of a car company starts to think that they're running the Formula One team. Because let's be clear, they know nothing about Formula One. And it is a totally, totally different business from the business of running a car company. And in ways that no one can even imagine. You know, I always remember Richard Driscoll, the chief financial officer at Jordan Grand Prix, when I was on the management board there. I remember Richard saying one day, Formula One is a business like no other. There's no business in the world that prepares you for what you have to do to be successful in Formula One, because the rule book gets thrown out the window. If you want to win in Formula One, you have to do things in a completely different manner from most normal companies. Most normal companies work on 3 to 5 year strategies. You know, Formula One teams have to learn how to react on a lap by lap, minute by minute, day by day, week by week, month by month basis. The agility you need to drive success in Formula One is of a totally different magnitude from anything else, including running a car company. So to your point, you know, Vigna has been in the role, I think he joined in June 2021. If he's been in the role of chief executive for Ferrari, obviously he's going to be fascinated by the F1 team. Who wouldn't be? If you were chief executive of Ferrari, you'd want to have the grid passed around your neck and be, you know, getting involved in whatever you could. But the reality is he has no experience of Formula One, of running a Formula One team. And it is totally a different game from anything else that he will have done in his career. And quite honestly, Frédéric Vasseur is a diehard racer with a huge amount of operational experience of running racing teams. He will have relished this opportunity to get into Ferrari. And if he's got into Ferrari, only to find that he has a boss who is, whatever his intentions, is effectively undermining his position, that's going to be completely destructive. The two of them, if it's true that there's conflict there or tension, they really need to sort it out in quick order, because, you know, disappointment from Charles Leclerc in what's happening during race weekends would be nothing compared to if Ferrari just has another season dissolve away with internal tensions and friction. Because let's be clear, Leclerc's career is washing away before his eyes, and he won't want to stay there. And there are, I mean, we talked about Audi earlier on, for example. There's not going to be a shortage of teams who'd want to have Charles Leclerc in the near future. And it's going to be, it's vital that Ferrari get their act together in terms of that alignment that they need amongst all the people in the team, and get a sense of clear direction and deliver and focus on beating the competition rather than the internal struggles that seem to take up too much of their time.
Roberto and Andrew both agree one of the major things that needs to be sorted out this year is tying Leclerc in and giving him a reason to stay.
Yeah, well, first of all, I remember when he first signed that contract, long-term thing, and now by the end of this year, he'll be effectively deciding his future, won't he, if it expires at the end of 2024. And there's no denying, I don't think it's quite like Max Verstappen ignoring Red Bull team orders in Brazil and not getting so much as a slap on the wrist, but Leclerc is obviously the talisman at Ferrari to the point where Vasseur was hired basically to placate Leclerc in many ways after his frustration and breakdown of his relationship with Binotto. So the fact that they are appealing to Leclerc shows how important he is to Ferrari. But I wrote a column about this for Autosport last year. It sort of shot down a bit, but my colleagues. But you do wonder, not necessarily where he will end up, but is he having a two-year version of Lewis Hamilton's 2012 at McLaren, where there are these flashes of immense pace, you know, particularly what he had last year, but just the gearbox problems that, you know, Hamilton had, or the poorly executed race strategy, the fragility, and it just thinks I've had enough. Like he's done the Ferrari thing now. Apart, you know, he had his rookie season at Alfa Romeo, but he's done the Ferrari thing. So whether his appetite is whetted to look beyond, because if he is to, like last season, what the best statistic from last season was that Max Verstappen won more races from Charles Leclerc poles than Charles Leclerc won from Charles Leclerc poles, and that sort of poor conversion rate is enough to make you shop around. And whether it is that, you know, Hamilton retires and Mercedes goes to Leclerc, or Mercedes goes to Norris, so a resurgent McLaren needs a star signing alongside Piastri, or the Audi program, which will, you know, if the cost cap hasn't clamped down on driver salaries, then it will be able to effectively write a blank check for Leclerc. He doesn't have a shortage of options. I think, you know, both parties, McLaren and Leclerc, would dearly love it to work out with one another, because they would be, you know, Leclerc would become, well, not a cult hero, that makes him sound a bit like John Alesi, but he'd be like almost a deity around that place. But the trajectory it's on at the minute is, to just underline everything Marcus said, it's not going that way.
The Alesi comparison is a good one, because he's another person who is seen very much as the heir to Gilles Villeneuve, as Leclerc is. But Matt, have you got Christopher Hilton's John Alesi book?
I do. I'm a terrible if my girlfriend's going to, let's say, shop for my birthday present or something like that, I'll nip into Oxfam and go through every shelf and find out such gems.
Christopher Hilton, a lovely and much missed bloke. He used to write in his dressing gown for much of the day before having a bath and going out to get the papers and things like that. It's a very, very eccentric, but very enthusiastic, lovely bloke. Yeah, thanks for bringing back the memory. I had a very great and boozy lunch with Christopher Hilton once, and he wanted to stay for more. I said, Chris, I've got to work. You need to go to the archive. I've got to work. Anyhow, magazine deadlines being what they are, when Mark was writing his feature about Williams for this issue and the changes and what the new team principal, James Vowles, needs to do to turn things around, James had only just started in the job with the benefit of observing for a couple of Grand Prix weekends. I mean, what do we make of him now? I've been quietly impressed by James Vowles. And as you were saying earlier, Mark, about people who know what they're doing in motor racing, here's a guy who has had, he may not be an experienced team principal, but he's worked next to one, he's worked for one, he's executed strategy, he's managed a process that requires minute attention to detail, multitasking, the calculation of possibilities in real time. So he's clearly got a big brain. And you can see all that going on when he's being interviewed. You know, there's an awful lot of wheels turning in that head. And I've been quietly impressed with what I've seen so far.
You couldn't wish to have a better university for becoming team principal than what he's been able to enjoy and contribute to. Well, during his 20 plus years in Brackley, you know, as I mentioned, you know, in the feature, that period of time that he's been there, he has seen Brackley evolve from its BAR through its Honda, through its Braun, through its Mercedes-Benz phase, which means he's worked with your Toto Wolffs and your James Allisons and your Ross Brauns, and he's experienced working with Dave Richards. And so he's seen leadership in quite different styles. But the one thing that, you know, Dave Richards and Ross Brawn and Toto Wolff all have in common is that they've been very good at what they do from a leadership perspective. So in motorsport. So he's had an extremely good apprenticeship, if you can call it that, to become a team principal. As you say, he's got a good brain, incredibly good body at the specific jobs that he had within those teams, and then the broader roles. And I think one of the things I find interesting when I talk to, you know, very senior engineers now in Formula One, if you talk to technical directors, you talk to senior engineers, you realize that actually the bit that kind of gets forgotten is that given the complexity of modern F1, if you end up in a senior technical role, you're effectively leading a group of people. You're in the team building role. So you're in the role of inspiring people, motivating people, allocating resources, making sure you getting the best possible outcome. So therefore, not only is someone like James Vowles technically capable, but they're also very capable as leaders because they're leading teams of people. Now, may not be the size of an entire F1 team, may just be a department or a function within that team. But once you've acquired those soft skills in terms of communicating with people, leading people, inspiring people, you can scale that. And clearly in taking the Williams opportunity, he's able to unleash that leadership potential that, you know, is there within him to run an entire operation. And clearly Dorrelton, you know, the owners of Williams have met with him, found him to be, you know, someone who inspires confidence. And because of his demeanor, the way he comes across, that vast experience that he brings with him. And therefore, it seems like an extremely good move. It's a fact that he has never run a Formula One team, and therefore this is a step which is huge. Whatever function or role that you've had before, that final step into leadership of an F1 team means that you suddenly have new dimensions to your role that you've never had to really worry too much about before. Obviously, a huge amount of media attention on you as a team principal. You're effectively in a chief executive type role. You are having to deal with the commercial partners of the team. There will be demand on your time from them. You're going to have to get, and of course, the commercial side of Williams has been one of its fundamental weaknesses over the year. There's never been the funding, the third party commercial funding and sponsorship in the team for some years that's enabled it to invest the money in its facilities, etc. So the commercial side of the team is a weakness, and it's one that he will have to pay attention to. And then all the other stakeholder audiences, you know, Formula One, the FIA, all of the other, dealing with drivers, dealing with contracts, dealing with personnel, senior personnel, issues and changes. As Matt mentioned, you've got, when a team is in transition, as Williams is, where they need to appoint senior roles, they need to structure that organization. As James says in the piece, he talks about the fact that they're kind of making do at the moment. They're kind of trying to fill gaps where they can. So it's very much all hands on deck trying to keep Williams going along this year whilst he puts in place a structure for the long term. So it's a very interesting challenge, one that unfortunately for James is going to be played out in the full, public scrutiny that we will give to it in every weekend, everything he says, all the press conferences that he takes part in, and of course the results of the team. But as I also mentioned in the feature, of course, one of the points which is quite interesting is that this year's Williams car was effectively conceived under the leadership of the two people who are no longer in the team. So, FX de Maison and Jos Capito. And I mean, again, I watched at the weekend, the last race, second race of the season, kind of watching Williams's performance and watching it relative to AlphaTauri and McLaren, and I'm thinking, yeah, it's really interesting time to watch. And I'm sure James will be very aware that, the car that they've got this year has really been conceived in the era before he joined the team. And obviously there's a lot of good to be taken from that, because it means that there's been a lot of people in the team working hard to improve their performance into this year. And hopefully he can build on that. But in the final analysis, very early days for him. I think my big point would be that, just as we talked about Ferrari, Frédéric Vasseur, Benedetto Vigna, what's completely critical for James Vowles is that he really genuinely does get given the time and the support necessary to do the job that needs to be done at Williams. And that's not going to be counted in races or months, but in years. And again, realistically, with just 3 years to go before the advent of the huge regulation change that takes place in 2026, for me, that's where they need to be focusing. They need to be saying, what do we need to do in 2023, 2024, and 2025 to put in place the building blocks to ensure that Williams is a competently competitive midfield team in the new era of Formula One in 2026? And those 3 years are going to fly by. All the novelty of his new role this year will just disappear in the blink of an eye. Before he'll know it, he'll be into 2024, and he'll be thinking about the fact that in 18 months' time, they've got to have a 2026 car ready on the block. So it's, for me, again, once again, all about stability, alignment, getting that coherent structure in place, and him being given the time by the shareholders to do the job that unquestionably I think he's capable of.
I have to say, Mark, you talking about this year's car, I loved that piece in your feature where you just note that Capito just put on LinkedIn after they got points in Australia that he wanted to credit all his team who had been involved with the FW45. I like that. It's fascinating insight. And I do wonder if that car's a bit too competitive. It sort of gives Williams a problem, because Vowles came out early on and said, we probably won't really develop this car. We expect this season to be a write-off about the greater good long-term plan. And the fact it is it's so far showing it can be a contender for points every so often, that whether it is worth developing it and therefore scoring more points, more prize money, better places in the Constructors' Championship, especially when AlphaTauri are doing so sort of dismally. Or so dismal at the minute, and then more sponsors as a result of that. But of course, that's an even more difficult decision to make, because they don't have a technical director who can lead that decision or go, no, we're going to pile everything into next season. But on Vowles specifically, it's been really interesting to watch how he conducts himself and how considered he is. So what's one example is in Australia he was asked and about how he's finding life at Williams, and he said he was very clear that Mercedes hasn't given me a full picture. It's not sort of stamped out a ready-made team principle. I'm having to learn. And as part of an extension of that, when he was given that position, I think we all assumed straight away that he would be a political ally for Toto Wolff come what may. And that may still well be the case with all the commission votes that go on behind closed doors. But just watching how he conducts himself in press conferences or out and about, is he's trying to avoid, I think, quietly, that Toto Wolff comparison, in the sense that they were asked a couple of joint questions in Saudi Arabia, and Toto Wolff was trying to bring Vowles in and engage and sort of have a joke about, oh, I can't believe we let you go, that sort of thing. And Vowles didn't really entertain it. I think he, you know, he's trying to just establish that I want to be held in my own right, thank you very much. Not a slight on Toto Wolff, or not throwing shade at him, as the kids would say, but just wanting to be held in his own right. And I thought that was really interesting. And obviously, as Mark says, what we're seeing now is not Vowles' responsibility, even down to the signing of Logan Sargeant. He actually said when Mercedes were looking at him, we thought no thanks, and now he's managing him. And that was obviously a Capito decision to get rid of Latifi ultimately and hire in Sargeant. And that's where I want to sort of throw to link some of this podcast together, throw to the Benedetto Vigna comparison, which is that Ferrari, the road car company, is in great shape at the minute. It's got, you know, the 296, a darling of all the automotive journalists. It's just launched the Puro Sangue SUV, which are all great success stories, but none of them were conceived by him, but he can lap up the credit, in the same way that what we're seeing now is not a manifestation of any of Vowles' decisions. And apart from sort of observing how the race team operates, I bet he would love it to be 2025, 2026, so that all the things he's identified are in sort of motion, and he can take credit for that. So it has been good to watch him. He's been, like I say, reserved, but in a good way, and considered, and just gone about things sort of in the right way. And the fact he's saying that everything in the job interview did align with the Dorilton Capital board suggests that this is a longer term appointment, and they are going to be patient. And the other thing that really struck me in terms of tone from Saudi Arabia is that Franz Tost threw this brilliant sort of grenade in at his team, saying, I don't trust my engineers anymore, their numbers are doing one thing, our car's rubbish. Vowles has gone the opposite of that. He's going, I wasn't here, I've been at an 8-time Constructors' Championship, so I don't know what you guys are going through, but I can feel that this team has endured a lot of pain, you know, and I feel for the guys here. And what, and just that completely different mentality of, instead of Toss slamming his team while they're down, Vowles is going, you know, I'm here, guys, I'm you're bruised, I can sense that, but we're together, we can pick ourselves back up. And just that difference in approach is just something well worth noting.
Yes, was it Tottenham Hotspur's manager who's been doing something similar recently? I know nothing about football, but our vice president of editorial, Mr. Dickens, is a fan and seems to spend most of his Twitter time tweeting about what an egregious oaf this manager is. It's not really what you want, is it, for the manager to wade in and say, I'm doing a great job, but you are all idiots.
I think the passing of Dietrich Mateschitz, owner of Red Bull, was always going to be a significant moment. And although Red Bull as an organisation has stabilised the ship, and they've got a clear management structure in place, I'm talking about the Red Bull energy drinks company and the way in which Formula One and other sporting activities fit under that, feels like change is inevitable. And you wonder how long that change is going to when will that take place? How will it manifest itself? We've already seen stories around Helmut Marko's position in terms of his relationship with the new leadership at Red Bull. You have to wonder about Franz Tost, because Franz is very much part of that, if you kind of old school setup that they put in place at Red Bull. And I suspect that he's been frustrated, you know, and of course, it's one thing being frustrated when you report to the person who maybe you've had an incredibly long-standing, strong relationship. If you now are frustrated but reporting to someone who actually just wants results and is perhaps questioning, you know, why have we got two Formula One teams? There have already been stories about AlphaTauri being up for sale, and then that was dismissed. Well, of course they dismiss it, because you were never going to say, well, you know, it's all up for sale. But you'd have to say everything's going to be on the cards. And I think one of the interesting stories over the course of, again, this year and next, is going to be how that whole Red Bull structure evolves. And when I read Franz's comments, I know Franz Tost from way back when he was managing Ralf Schumacher, it's unusual to get that kind of an outburst, because Franz would know that that's not going to help anybody by being publicly critical of your team. I mean, that doesn't make for a happy team. So I kind of wonder about the frustrations in there. So that's going to be a story worth keeping an eye on over the next couple of years as we leave the Mateschitz era of Red Bull behind us and move into this new era of professional leadership, who will unquestionably look at everything that they do in sport quite differently, including Formula One.
Yeah, people like to carve out roles for themselves when great leaders pass, don't they? So there's always a period of squabbling in the aftermath.
Armando Iannucci did a very good film about all of that.
He did indeed, The Death of Stalin. Speaking of satire, the sort of entrenched belief that James Vowles was going to be some sort of puppet of Toto Wolff on the political front made me think, and readers of a certain age will get this, or certain readers, listeners even of a certain age will recall this very well, the spitting image, the satirical puppet programme used to portray the two leaders of the Liberal Democrat Party, David Owen, as a full-size puppet with his co-leader, David Steele, as sort of like a pocket-sized puppet that would fit in his sort of top pocket and go, "Oh, David, yes, I agree with you." And I get the feeling that various people thought the James Vowles Toto Wolff relationship would work a little bit like that. It's interesting to see. Maybe that's not how it's going to go. And as you say at the end of your feature, Mark, I hope I'm not doing any spoilers when I give away the payoff, when he says, you know, the other team principals have been quite supportive of me so far. This may not last for long. You know, he's someone who has his own plans of how he's going to carve out his regime.
The last thing you would want when you come out from your 20 years at Brackley is to effectively have your former boss kind of metaphorically patting you on the head saying, "Oh, well, yes, he's going to do a fine job there." This is a bitter competition in Formula One. You know, James Vowles is not taking on the leadership role of Formula One to be a patsy to anybody. Yes, of course, he's got a strong relationship with Toto Wolff, and I'm sure that's not going to change. And yes, of course, the relationship between Williams and Mercedes is extremely important because of their powertrain suppliers. So that's going to continue. But in the same way, as it's essential that Dorrelton give James the space and the time to do his job, it's also really important he makes it his own and stamps his authority on that. And that includes going into head-to-head competition with his former team. Otherwise, there's no point in doing it.
Speaking of space and time, we've run up against our sort of hour limit. Once Martin's deleted all the naughty stuff that is absolutely unbroadcastable. So it is time to say thank you very much to my guests. Mark Gallagher, probably about bedtime for you, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about bedtime for me, and tomorrow I'm going down for the first day of the Adelaide Motorsport Festival and look forward to having a bit of a chat with Valtteri Bottas on Sunday afternoon, hopefully clothed. That's both him and me. That's both him and me when we do it. But I'm looking forward very much to that, and then heading over to Melbourne for the Grand Prix.
And Matt, thank you very much. Are you on deck in Australia, or have you got this one off?
I'm not on deck in Australia, but my immediate plans involve writing a feature for you that's due in about 12 hours from now.
Yes, it very much is. So, you know, in the grand tradition of great leadership, I'm going to say, work harder, you mangy dog.
Can I say, Codders, I'm heeding your advice. It is, of course, written, but I'm taking some time between writing and filing to fully appreciate whether there's any edits I may want to make.
This is very good. You have to sort of do the whole swoosh thing. Imagine that you hadn't written it and you're reading it cold. And so it's what I did with the thing I submitted yesterday morning before I submitted it to myself. Anyway, thanks to all our listeners. Thanks to the long-suffering Martin Lee, our producer, for more fabulous content, as we must call these things nowadays, you can buy our magazine. It comes out every month. Go to gpracing.com to find out our subscriber offers. You can find out your nearest stockist if you live in the UK by going to Seymour. That's as in the lady who played Solitaire in the James Bond films. Seymour.co.uk. Type your... And it is actually working because I checked it before I hit record. It's working again. The store finder will now accept your postcode and you will find out which shops stock GP Racing. Thank you very much. We will speak to you again next month. Enjoy the next couple of Grand Prix.